First You Think is a not-for-profit ministry of the First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. Support us at ucdsm.org today.
Imagine a religion where people of different beliefs worship as one faith. Back in the aughts, a Unitarian Universalist ad campaign promoted this slogan. Imagine a religion where people of different beliefs worship as one faith. How could that be? One faith, one religion, many beliefs. That's possible because religion isn't really about belief. So when I'm asked, what do Unitarian Universalists believe? I usually answer, what Unitarian Universalists believe is that your religion isn't about what you believe. So what is religion about? I'm so glad you asked. Three things. One, it's about how you live, the ethics and values that guide your life. Two, it's about community, the people you come together with to share in rituals that affirm your community bond. Three, it's about a certain kind of experience, the experiences we call religious experience or spiritual experience, those moments of transcendence and awe, of apprehending the beauty and wonder and oneness of all things. Now, those are three rather different things, and yet a faith institution exists to weave them together so that each one supports the and reinforces the other two. The ethics and values that guide your life facilitate your community belonging and prepare you to be open to transcendent experience. Your faith community helps reinforce certain ethics and values and also helps lay the ground for you to have transcendent experiences. And transcendent experiences expose you to a oneness that awakens compassion, which becomes a part of your ethics and values, and also draws you closer to community. In faith, community, each strand of the braid is shaped and directed so that it can reinforce the other two. The idea that religion is about believing goes back to St. Paul. When Paul invented the religion known as Christianity, his big innovation was to make believing what it was all about. And when Islam came along 6 centuries later, it followed Paul's model. And so Islam is also belief-centric. But the other world religions are not. The Asian religions, they have teachings, but if you happen not to accept a few of them, that's fine. And what makes a person Jewish isn't what they believe, but what they practice, and that they have a shared history and understanding of themselves as a people under the laws. From our roots in Christianity, Unitarian Universalism has traveled a long road back from belief-centric religion, and it was a road of understanding ourselves more and more as a people of covenant, not creed, which is to say, not belief. A key step on that road was the Cambridge Platform. I'd like you to know the Cambridge Platform, if you don't, or know of it a little bit. The Puritans who founded the Plymouth Colony in 1620 and the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630 proceeded to adopt in 1648 the Cambridge Platform. These Puritans didn't have a strong political tradition other than the sense of being bound in covenant. They felt need for neither a creed nor a specific structure of church governance. After all, they were God's people bound together by covenant, and that was enough. But today, we don't agree with those Puritans on much, but we are their descendants. 200 years after the Plymouth Landing, or invasion, the Unitarian denomination formed consisting of New England congregations that split from their Congregationalist Puritan past. We've left behind the focus on sin, the doctrine of total depravity and of predestination. We have sought and still seek to correct the way that covenant was used to dismiss and disrespect and oppress people, such as the indigenous people that were deemed then not to be in the covenant. One thing we have kept from our Puritan forebears is this sense that we are a people of covenant, not bound together by creed. Unitarians today are for a generation, the Plymouth, and the Puritan did that after did need to have a polity. Of the principle of their church would Presbyterianizing them for a polity. So they did Episcopal polity, which is what at that time had. They didn't want Presbyterian governance by called presbyters is what back in England churches had, distinguishing that is from the Church of England. The Puritans would also have been aware of Catholic Church's governance, and that was definitely out of the question for them. So they decided in 1600 to create a polity that was none of the above. It would be a polity based on covenant, and they called it congregational polity. And the Cambridge Platform 1648 spelled what this congregational polity meant. They laid out a basic form of for congregations to have, a role for pastors, for teachers, ruling elders who oversaw church administration. They authorized a few ways that congregations had responsibilities to each other. They were to take thought for each other's welfare, consult and advise, admonish congregations that erred, members of one member to receive communion in other churches, send letters of recommendation, a member goes to a new church, and financially assist poor churches. Beyond these, each congregation was autonomous. The Cambridge Platform of 1648 is the foundational document of congregational polity, the polity we still follow today. Along with our free search for truth and meaning comes free self-governance. We make our own bylaws, elect our own board, hire our own staff, call our own minister, buy and own and maintain our own buildings and grounds. It's up to us alone to fund the maintenance of our home, the programs, the ministry through which we nurture our spirits and help heal our world. Critics of congregational polity call it a type of religious anarchism. And there is some truth to that. Still, we share our congregational polity with a number of other denominations. The United Church of Christ, formerly known as the Congregationalist Church, also descends from those New England Puritan churches, namely the ones that didn't break away to become Unitarian. And they also have that congregational polity. Baptists and various forms of non-denominational Christianity have congregational polity, as do Quakers, Disciples of Christ, most Jewish synagogues, many Sikh gurdwaras, and most Islamic mosques in the U.S. Some of these are also officially creedless, although they do have shared scripture. Unitarian Universalists are, to the best of my knowledge, alone in being held together neither by the authority of a creed, nor by the authority of a common scripture, nor under the authority of a bishop, synod, diocese, presbytery, or conciliatory. Which raises the question, well, what does hold us together? Sometimes, sadly, the answer is nothing, and we come apart. Congregations acrimoniously split or dissolve. When we are held together, the name for our sticking by each other is covenant. Another covenant that may be more familiar to us, that even secular folks have the experience of covenant, is the marriage covenant. That's sort of an example that we can look to see how it works. That is a promise to stick together, to share each other's lives, to provide mutual support. The words of the vow can be highly variable, but at base it comes down to promising to stick together, share each other's lives, and provide mutual support. It's a committing of our lives that is ultimately beyond what any set of words can capture, whether those words are the vows spoken at a marriage ceremony or the words of a congregation's covenant. Yes, you can make a promise without signing a piece of paper, whether that paper is a marriage certificate or a membership book. You don't have to sign anything to make a promise. It's just that signing makes the promise public, makes the relationship public. Signing that paper tells the world that you have entered into a sacred relationship with a spouse in one case, with a congregation in the other. Our greatest 20th century Unitarian theologian, James Luther Adams, understood God to be community-forming power. That power, which comes into existence when human beings gather in a group and which allows that group to form itself into a community, that's what James Luther Adams called God. So Adams did a great deal of thinking and writing about voluntary associations, about the covenants that are the community-forming power. The Unitarian Universalist Association's Commission on Appraisal issues a report every 4 years. Their 2021 report was called Unlocking the Power of Covenant. The commission observed, "We are the promises we make and the vows we break." A covenant, it says, is a mutual sacred promise between individuals or groups to stay in relationship, care about each other, and work together in good faith. They go on to say, quote, "No single concept is more central to our faith understanding than being in covenant. It's at the core of our identity. It's how we try to build and sustain the beloved community. It is the foundation of our governance structures at all levels," end quote. Ultimately, the covenant is beyond language, beyond what words can say. It's the embodied commitment to keep on being together in love. Married couples may have long forgotten the exact words of the vow they spoke on their wedding day. Yet as long as they remain married and together, they are embodying their covenant in their way of being together. The ultimate covenant is beyond words, but is embodied in our way of being together. It's expressed in our patterns of interaction. Still, attempting to put the wordless into words can be helpful. Giving it some words, inevitably imperfect and needing regular revision, but still some words to express our commitment to each other, that can provide helpful guidance about how we shall be together. For congregations, covenants come in two main forms. There's aspirational covenants and there's behavioral covenants. Behavioral covenants delineate the behaviors we promise to follow or avoid. Because behavior is publicly observable, we can notice when someone has broken covenant and encourage zeer back in the right relationship that our covenant says we promise to uphold. It's a reality of being a people of covenant, that we sometimes do break covenant. And that reality means that being a people of covenant also entails being a people of forgiveness, recognizing that we stray and calling each other back over and over, every time we do. The life of covenant turns out to be less about staying and more about returning. Over and over and over again. Reverend David Pyle was with us this weekend for a startup workshop that some of you were here for. Reverend Pyle has had some Zen training, as have I, and he referenced the basic teaching for Zen meditation, focus on your breath. We usually suggest first-timers count their breaths, 1 to 10, and then start over at 1. Or just bring your attention to the breath coming in and going out. Your mind will wander off. It will start thinking about one darn thing or another. That's okay. That's what minds do. The mind secretes thoughts the way the liver secretes bile. The practice is, as soon as you notice you've wandered off, bring your attention back to the breath. The practice is the coming back. The point of a 25-minute meditation sit is not to be so concentrated that you stay focused on the breath the whole time. The point is to spend that time coming back over and over, noticing a thought, letting it go, returning to the breath. Returning to the breath is the practice. And as Reverend Pyle pointed out, coming back is also the point of the practice of covenant, to return over and over to mindfulness of the promises that define who you are. Our aspirational covenant is our mission: grow ethically and spiritually, serve justly and love radically. That is not behaviorally defined. There's no stipulation as to what behavior constitutes growing ethically and spiritually or serving justly and loving radically. So we can't judge whether someone else is out of covenant. Certain behaviors might cause us to inquire gently whether the person is keeping the aspiration in mind, but ultimately, only you can decide if you are keeping the covenant to grow and to serve and to love. And only you can assess how well or how poorly you're growing, serving, and loving. You haven't broken covenant. You haven't broken this covenant unless you've stopped trying. Stopped aspiring to grow and serve and love. Stopped bringing your mind back to this covenant every time you notice you've drifted off from it. Behavioral covenants, on the other hand, do stipulate some behaviors. Because behaviors are observable, behavioral covenant allows us to go the further step of holding each other in relationship of accountability. We have a team at work now developing a behavioral covenant for this congregation. Covenants make us. They spell out who we are. And when I don't know who us is, then I don't know who me is. By becoming more conscious of our covenants, spoken and unspoken, we can live into them more fully and become who we are with greater awareness and greater intentionality. Marcia Pally's 2016 book, Commonwealth and Covenant, recognizes that we need both situatedness and separability. We need to be situated, embedded in functional and caring families and thick communities that define our values and ourselves. Villages of ordinariness in which you can be your plain old ordinary self without the constant expectation to prove yourself. And we also need separability. We need to have the freedom and the support to go off and create and explore and experiment with new ways of thinking and living. What creates situatedness, notes Pally, is covenant. A contract protects interests, she said, but a covenant protects relationships. A covenant exists between people who understand they are part of one another. It involves a vow to serve the relationship that is sealed by love. Contracts stipulate an exchange of goods or services, but people in covenant delight in offering their gifts. We are here to offer each other what gifts we can, to hold open the space of grace. It's about seeing the goodness and dignity and the failings and foibles of one another and still loving each other. I was once leading a Zen group that met weekly in the second and third grade classroom of our church. Every week, we Zen practitioners would gather in this room, and there on the wall, handwritten with marker on newsprint, was the class covenant. It showed all the signs of a process in which grown-ups were drawing the language as best they could out of the 7- and 8-year-olds so that it would really be the kids' own covenant. It said things like, 1, listen and speak when someone is holding the speaking stone. And there was 3, pick up after each other and ourselves. Don't litter. Notice, pick up after each other and ourselves, not just after ourselves. The last one was 11, come together with a calm and open mind. Nice. My favorite one, though, was number two. Be kind to others even when they're not your friend. Even our kids grasp the gist of the point that being a people of covenant means seeing goodness and dignity even among the failings and foibles of one another and still loving each other. It's about giving of ourselves and being called together into a different way of being in the world. I have been held and held together in covenant with Unitarian Universalists my whole life. And now I am held in covenant with you. It is such a wonder. Thank you so much.